We are in the book of Joel. I thought this is like a big sports day, so I thought I would dress up all sportsy-like. I figured if I dressed up like a Bronco fan, I'd alienate half of the room. If I dressed up like a Seahawks fan, I'd alienate the other half of the room, you know. A Chiefs fan, then I would make a very good friend even closer. Yes, yes. Or there's the Chargers, you know, we're not going to go there. So I thought I would remind you that baseball season is right around the corner. And one day I'll get me a Dodger thing too, you know, okay, buddy? We won't forget the Dodgers. We won't forget the Dodgers. But for today, it's Pujols. There we go. Joel chapter 3. I'm going to finish the book this morning. Joel chapter 3. Joel's prophecy came when the land was hit by an invasion of locusts followed by a drought. Joel saw this as punishment for the sins of the people. He also saw this locust invasion as a picture of a bigger invasion, one that would come during a time that we have come to know as the day of the Lord, the day of Yahweh. In the narrowest sense, because it's used various ways, but in the narrowest sense, it is speaking of what we call the tribulation period, 7 years on the earth where hell is poured out, where judgment is poured out on the earth. And it's a period that ends with the return of Jesus. And I don't know if you were here last week, but we were trying to make the point that this is coming very soon. If you missed last week, look it up. Go to the website, click on webcast, go to the archives. You ought to pay attention to these things. We ought to wake up. It's coming. It's very soon. Very, very soon. We are primed right now for one of the prime opportunities for Jesus to show up. It's just that last little domino they're waiting to get tipped over, and boom, 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 and it will happen quick. So we want to be ready, beloved. We want to be ready. Chapter 3, verse 1 of Joel. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations. They have also divided up my land. I want to bring a couple things out here. We're going to camp on these verses for a few minutes. He talks about this happening when I bring back the captives. Friends, the last days are characterized by the return of the Jews to Israel. This is one of the things. This is one of the signs. When Israel was declared a nation, which itself is a miracle, when Israel was declared a nation in 1948, the population in Israel was about 1 million. Probably, maybe half of them were Jews in Israel. Since 1948, over 3 million Jews have immigrated to Israel. That, along with population growth today, Israel's population, 2014, is at 8 million, of which 6.1 million are Jews. This is the first time, I think it's this year or last year, this is the first time in history that the nation with the most Jews is Israel. The second most nation is who? It's us. But they've crossed us this year. There's now more Jews in Israel than there are in the United States. That's kind of a very cool thing. It's a very cool thing. God says that he will gather nations in the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, I'm going to make this a little hard for you today. I'm going to make you think. So I'm going to present to you choices. I'm not going to just make it all easy and just tell you what the real thing is. You'll have to put your thinking caps on today. Where is the valley of Jehoshaphat? Because there is no place on a map called the valley of Jehoshaphat. I'm going to give you four ideas, and as we get through our passage today, hopefully you'll have settled on an answer that the correct one. If not, I'll point it out to you, don't worry. Here's some suggestions. One is that it will be a new valley. Zechariah 14:4 says, "And in that day his feet," Jesus' feet, "will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north, half of it toward the south." Mount of Olives. We're looking at the Temple Mount. This is north going up. There's the Mount of Olives. And the idea is that the Mount of Olives will split half to the north, half to the south, creating a valley perhaps all the way down to the Dead Sea. And in fact, if just the Mount of Olives splits, then there's going to be a valley that will connect all. There's tons of valleys between. Jerusalem is about 2,000 feet in altitude. The Dead Sea is the lowest place on the planet Earth. It is about 1,500 feet below sea level. So it's just all downhill. If the Mount of Olives splits, then it will have a good chunk straight shot to the Dead Sea. We'll pick that up later. Second theory is that this Valley of Jehoshaphat is speaking of the Kidron Valley. This is a bit of the more traditional view. You'll see this in a lot of commentaries. And this is one of the reasons why you will see on the Mount of Olives, across from the Temple Mount, you'll see the hill is covered with graves. It's tied to that. I'm not going to fill out all the blanks for you. But the Kidron Valley is this valley that runs next to the Temple Mount. And there's the Mount of Olives and that whole area. That's all one big, huge Jewish cemetery. The Kidron Valley eventually goes south and then heads to the east and dumps out in the Dead Sea. Now, some people have suggested that this is the Valley of Jehoshaphat because in 2 Chronicles 20, there's a story, remember, of Jehoshaphat's great deliverance. That's homework for you if you don't know this story, where he's being attacked by the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Edomites. They've all ganged up, and they start off tracking them in En-Gedi, which is down about here. And it says in the text that they start ascending at the ascent of Aziz, and Jehoshaphat's supposed to go up to the wilderness of Tekoa. So there is a valley that goes along here. So I think that's actually where that battle takes place, not the Kidron Valley. I hope that made sense. If not, sorry. You don't need to pay attention to this one anyway. A third idea is that it's unknown, that we don't know where this Valley of Jehoshaphat is, and that the point is not about the location, but the name. Because Jehoshaphat means Yahweh has judged. The Jeho is Yahweh. It's a form of Yahweh. Shaphat means judged. So the idea is that wherever this is the place where God is going to judge. I like that. Fourth idea is the Jezreel Valley. Jezreel is up in the north of Israel. It's a valley that's up in this area. It's where Armageddon takes place, because Armageddon means the hill of Megiddo, and this is the valley, the Jezreel Valley. It's about 25 miles wide. This is the location of Armageddon. And so another theory is that this Valley of Jehoshaphat, the valley where Yahweh judges, could be Jezreel Valley, Armageddon. Now it says that God will enter into judgment with the nations. The Hebrew word for judgment is, I just told it to you, it's Shaphat. That's the word that's used here. God will enter into judgment, as in Jehoshaphat. At this place, God will enter into judgment. Now, this idea of gathering the nations and judging them carries two ideas in Scripture. You could look at them as mutually exclusive and choose one or the other. I kind of think that it's all kind of rolled up into one. I hope I can make sense of this. The first idea is the idea of actually judging people. Jesus tells a story. Why don't you look at Matthew chapter 25? Look at Matthew chapter 25, and we're going to see very similar language here about judgment taking place. Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46. Jesus is telling a parable. He's telling a story. And he says, Matthew 25, 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. And look what it says in verse 32. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. That's a very similar picture than what we're seeing in Joel, correct? Gathering the nations and then bringing judgment, separating one from the other. Jesus is painting a picture that Jewish people in Israel understand. So let me fill in some blanks of what this is all about.
In the Bible's shepherding metaphor, sheep represent the souls that choose God, while the souls who don't are the goats. We're not sure why. Maybe it's because goats are stronger and therefore often mean to sheep. Whatever the reason, it's often not hard to imagine goats as representing evil. Almost all Bedouin own both sheep and goats. But out in the field, I began to notice that many of the flocks were either made up of all goats or all sheep. All goats. All sheep. Goats. Sheep. Goats. The reason for this is that goats are tougher than sheep, and so they can feed in places that sheep can't. Therefore, shepherds don't want their goats grazing where only their sheep can go to feed. For this reason, in the early morning, a shepherd will separate his goats from his sheep. One shepherd takes the sheep into the gentle valleys to graze, while another shepherd takes the goats to a more rugged feeding ground. This process of separation is what Jesus used figuratively to describe what the day of judgment will be like.
So this idea of separating sheep from goats is a common thing. They see this all the time. They get gathered together at night, but in the morning, they're going to get separated. So this is a common thing. It's not hard to separate sheep from goats. Verse 33 in our text says, he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, which is who? The sheep. He will say to them, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. Now when you look at this, the righteous are identified by their good works. That's how he's able to tell the sheep from the goats, by their good works. He goes on in verse 41. He will also say to those on the left, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick in prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Now, he talks about what you've done to the least of these. Now, it could be just any person that you run into, but you can also make a case that the least of these, my brethren, is Israel, the Jews, because Jesus, by the way, was Jewish. I think I've heard it said that Jesus was not a Christian. You can make that point. He was Jewish. Now, he's the one we worship as Christians. He was Jewish. He was from Jewish stock. And he said, you do this to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. Now, judgment here is determined by how we treat others. And it almost sounds as if we are saved by doing good things to other people. But that's not quite it. Personally, I have a hard time telling different citrus trees apart. When I go walking in the morning, a lot of people have different kinds of citrus trees in their yards. And if you look at the leaves, they all look the same. Now, some of you might be, you know, agricultural specialists. You can tell a lemon tree from an orange tree. I personally cannot. I am not that smart. For me, the best way to tell a lemon tree from an orange tree is to wait for the fruit. And when the fruit comes, well, duh. Fruit proves what the tree already is. Fruit proves what the tree already is. My friend, your salvation is based solely on whether or not you trust Jesus to pay for your sins, to save you from your sins. That's what salvation is based on. And if the proof of your salvation is real, I mean, if your salvation is real, just like a tree bearing fruit, you will produce good works. If your life does not produce good works, if your life doesn't change coming to know Jesus, Houston, we have a problem. But if you know him, if you've trusted him for real, part of that trust will affect you and change you. We call it being born again. There's a new nature inside of you, and that nature produces fruit. It produces good works. So this is part of the idea of entering into judgment with the nations, is this idea of judging the sheep from the goats. But it also speaks of Armageddon. The judgment may indeed look like a worldwide battle. Armageddon is not just about war. It's about God judging the nations that have gathered together against Jesus. Revelation talks about that they're going to be gathered because they know he's coming back and they want to do something about it. And God will judge these nations. We'll see a little more about this later in the passage. Part of the reason for judgment, it says, is because they divided up my land in verse 2. There will be judgment based on the fact that these nations have divided up the land. Now, some of that can be talking about the fact that, various times in their history, the Jews have been scattered, whether it was the Assyrian captivity, the Babylonian captivity, or the Romans coming in and wiping out the nation, and they got scattered to the winds. But I personally am concerned about the direction of the current peace talks, because some of what is happening is that the land is getting divided up. It's a complicated thing. I would not even want to try to be involved with the peace process. I am not saying that Mr. Carey is a bad guy. God bless him for wanting to try. But I am a little concerned about the direction that it's going. I don't know if you're paying attention to this. This is all like this last week that things are heating up. Even yesterday, some statements were made where Senator Carey or Secretary Carey was warning Israel that they might face boycotts from the rest of the world if they don't do what he tells them to do. That came across like a bit of a threat, and then he came back saying, well, no, I wasn't threatening you, I was just telling you as it is. I'm just warning you the way the rest of the world looks at this. They're getting their arm twisted to do some things that they don't want to do, including dividing up Jerusalem. They want them to give away half of Jerusalem. These are complicated issues, very complicated issues. But when it comes to dividing the land, and I read this verse about judgment coming because they divided the land, I'm a little concerned about us. I'm a little concerned where it's going. Hey, you know, it might not come to nothing. It might be just like every other peace talks. I don't know. It says verse 3, they have cast lots for my people, having given a boy as a payment for a harlot and sold a girl for wine that they may drink. These are horrible things, selling children into slavery. Verse 4. Indeed, what have you to do with me, O Tyre and Sidon and all the coasts of Philistia? Will you retaliate against me? But if you retaliate against me swiftly and speedily, I will return your retaliation upon your own head. Now, some of these names here could be talking about the ancient enemies of Israel. Tyre, Sidon, and Philistia. Tyre and Sidon were the two original main chief cities of the Phoenician Empire, which eventually settled colonies all around the coast of the Mediterranean. And geographically, Tyre and Sidon, they're no longer cities, but they are north of Israel, up in what we think of as Lebanon today. The Philistines settled along the coast of Israel, including places like Gaza and Ashdod and Ekron and other places. The Palestinians today, the name, the title, Palestinians, comes from the Philistines. This isn't, I'm not telling you rocket science. It dates back to Egypt. Ancient Egypt, these people that we call the Philistines were called the Peleset. By the time Rome came around, they called the land of the Peleset the Palestine, that called it Palestine. 60, 70 years ago, the people who were living in the land when Israel was declared a nation took on this name and called themselves the Palestinians. I'm not saying that they are descendants of the Philistines. That's silly. They're Arabs, I believe. Actually, I'm going out on a limb there. I can't remember at the moment. But the name is tied to it. Lebanon is not in the finest of agreement with Israel right now. We get rockets fired at Israel all the time from Hezbollah up north. The Palestinians are not particularly fond of Israel right now either. It's interesting that it mentions these things. Verse 5, because you have taken my silver and my gold and have carried into your temples my prized possessions, talking about the ancient enemies, also the people of Judah and the people of Jerusalem, you have sold to the Greeks that you may remove them far from their borders. Talking about the Jews having been scattered throughout the world. Verse 7, behold, I will raise them out of the place to which you have sold them and will return your retaliation upon your own head. I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hands of the people of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabaeans, to a people far off, for the Lord has spoken. Mentions the Sabaeans. Sabaeans are the inhabitants of Sheba. Have you heard of Queen of Sheba? You know, she acts like the Queen of Sheba, something like that. I think somebody's grandma used to have a phrase like that. we connect Sheba with the area of Saudi Arabia. So that's those current inhabitants. The Sabaeans, like Phoenicians, were merchants. And this has been already partially fulfilled in history. But this prophecy also speaks of God dealing with Israel's enemies in general. Obadiah writes, For the day of the Lord upon all the nations is near. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. The day of the Lord is all about the righting of wrongs. It's making everything right. This is part, one aspect of God's judgment. It's about turning all the wrongs to right. Do you think that there's some things wrong in this world? You laugh. Anybody here think that there's plenty of things wrong in this world? And I'm not, don't go political on me. I'm just talking about the world we live in, right? Could you imagine what the world would be like if everything wrong turned right? I found a commercial. We may see it this afternoon that talks about this.
Man, I can't believe it's finally the week of greatness at Foot Locker.
A whole week of the most premium kicks? Feels like all is right with the world.
I'm sorry, Evander. It's your ear.
So, Mr. Rodman, round trip to North Korea?
One way.
One way?
Goodbye, old friends.
I okay?
Well, that's great. But a man's got to know when to walk away.
Yeah.
My ear.
I kept that in formaldehyde.
One way. He said one way.
He's never coming back.
Thanks.
I don't know. Things just feel different.
Well, this is part of what God's judgment is going to be about. Everything wrong is going to be turned right. And for us believers, we ought to be a part of that right now. Making things right with other people. And if you've got problems with people, Jesus talked about if you come to the altar and somebody's got a problem with you, you ought to go fix that problem with that other person first and then come to church. Make things right. Because that's what God is all about, friends. He's all about making things right. And when judgment comes, he's going to force it. It will be made right. Don't wait for that. Make things right now. Verse 9, proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, like take your plows and turn them into weapons, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Beat your plowshares into swords. Now, we're familiar with something that sounds very close to this. This is what takes place after Jesus returns. Isaiah says, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. There will be a day when all the weapons will be turned into agricultural implements. But that's not what Joel's saying. He's saying it just the opposite. He's saying that there's going to be a call to war. Take everything and turn it into weapons, he's going to say. Now, the United Nations has the Isaiah verse on a statue out in their park, and that's good. You know, there's some good things I'm glad about the United Nations. I'm tickled to hear about how it got started and the heart behind the people that started it. But I got news for you. Peace is not going to come in the world until Jesus returns. It's good that we strive for it. Glad that people work at it. Oh, it's good. That's good. Don't get me wrong. But gang, that doesn't happen. Turning weapons into plowshares, that doesn't happen till after Jesus comes back. And in fact, right now, it's going to get worse. Joel's verse is just the opposite. This is about nations preparing for war, for global war. Verse 11, assemble and come, all you nations. gather together all around. Cause your mighty ones to go down there, O Lord. Watch this. Let the nations be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. There's that valley again. Bring all the nations of the world, bring all your weapons, and show up in the valley of Jehoshaphat. He says, verse 13, put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, go down, for the winepress is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Now, he's using some, again, agricultural stuff for us, but this is stuff that ties it to other scriptures. John talks about the same picture in Revelation. He says, then another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar who had power over fire, and he cried with a loud cry to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vines of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. So the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trampled outside the city. Blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. Now, he's talking about judgment, but it's a harvest of, he's talking about harvest, but a harvest of judgment. A harvest of judgment that's coming. The land will be covered with blood. He says, up to the horses' bridles, it's like this high. The length that he mentions, 1,600 furlongs, that's the length of Israel. The whole nation will be covered with blood. John tells us who's actually treading this wine press, who's bringing this judgment, Revelation 19. See if you can guess who this is. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the wine press of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. Who's that? It's Jesus. It's Jesus. He's coming to judge the nations. And this battle, friends, is Armageddon. I kind of tend to lean toward the valley of Jehoshaphat, the valley of judgment being Jezreel, the place of Armageddon. Verse 14, he says, multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near. In the valley of decision. Now keep in mind, he's talking about Armageddon. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. This is about judgment coming. The one making the decision, multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, it's not about the people making decisions. They've already made their decisions. This is about God making his decisions, separating the sheep from the goats. God is the one making the decisions. If you make it to this point, if you are around on planet Earth when this happens, it will be too late to choose. Because at this point, God will be choosing for you where you are based on your choice. Over the last 7-8 months, I've had some experience with our court system. Learned a lot about court, more than I want to know about court. There's a fellow we've been involved with who has been charged with several felonies and a handful of misdemeanors that affected us, enough to land him in state prison for 3 years and 8 months if he was convicted and sentenced there. And over this last 7 or 8 months, I've probably been to court 7-8 times, something like that. And the court will say, you got to show up at 8 o'clock a.m., you know, in this division of the court. And so you show up and you wait. And there will be sometimes 40 cases that go through this thing, for these pretrial hearings. And you go through this thing waiting and waiting. And inevitably, I have no idea other than maybe this just to try my patience, but every single time, his case comes up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So you spend a whole day in court watching case after case, the most interesting people in court. One of the things I've learned in court, this is what I've learned by my time in court, by Richard Cathers. Here's my report. First thing is you learn to respect the judge. Let me give you a clue. If you end up in court and you're charged with something, pay attention, take notes, wear a nice buttoned-up shirt. Guys, if you got a tie, you better wear it. If you got a suit, you're doing good. Keep your hands out of your pockets and show some respect to the judge. Been in several courtrooms with several judges, and I'll tell you, they do not like it if you don't show respect. They do not like it. I've watched cocky street gang members come in. You know, their pants kind of set, you know, the down here, you know, kind of thing. Shorts, you know, hat turned on sideways, you know, that kind of thing. And going, hey, bro, you know. And the judge uses his teacher voice at moments like that. You know what that means? He gets really loud, and the courtroom goes quiet. The courtroom I spent the most time in, there's always chit-chatting going on because there's always like 10, 12 lawyers going on at the same time working with their clients and all this kind of stuff going on. But when the judge raises his voice, oh my gosh, everybody goes, and you know, gang members go turn white. White, it just like, oh my gosh. You learn to respect the judge. Respect the judge. He can sentence you to prison. He can put you out on parole. You learn to respect the judge. And even if your court date keeps getting postponed, because that's what we watched for 7 months, and everybody's like, why is this going on for so long? Even if your court case keeps getting postponed, one thing's for sure, you will be judged. It will happen. They don't forget. It will happen. Judgment will happen. The psalmist wrote, for he is coming, God is coming to judge the world, to judge the earth. He shall judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with his truth. The judge you and I need to most be concerned with is God. And you need to learn to respect him. You better learn to tremble in fear before God, lest he use his teacher voice. The sad truth is, friends, every single one of us is guilty. We are all, every single one of us. Me, I'm at the top of the list. We're all guilty, worthy of judgment. Romans 3:23 says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Every single one of us. And there is only one way that you are going to survive the judgment. There is only one way. Because there's only one person who has taken care of it. Who's had enough to be able to pay your price for you. That's Jesus. That's what he did when he died on the cross. He died to take your penalty so that you don't have to go to prison. You don't have to have the book thrown at you because he's already paid the price for you. If you will trust him, if you will start counting on him, if you will ask him to forgive you and to make you his child. The Bible says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's what he did dying on the cross. That whoever believes in him should not perish. You won't go to prison. You won't go to hell. Should not perish, but have everlasting life. My friend, if you've never taken this seriously, wake up. Because we're getting to a point when it's going to be too late. It's going to be too late. This is the time to choose. This is the time to follow him. Judgment is coming, friends. Judgment is coming. And having spent the last couple months in court, oh, you don't want to go there. You don't want to go there. Make your arrangements now. Make your plea deal now. Because God cares about you. God doesn't want you to be judged. He doesn't want you to be judged. God loved you so much, he sent Jesus for you. If you keep shaking your fist at him, if you keep saying, well, I'm going to do it my way. I don't care what you say. I'm king. Buddy, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. There will be a day when you face the judge. You will face the judge. And you won't be able to pull anything over his eyes. Let today be the day that you say yes to him. Verse 15, we're going back into these end times. Verse 15, which are right around the corner, gang. The sun and moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness. The Lord also will roar from Zion. There's that teacher voice there, huh? He'll roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and earth will shake, but the Lord will be a shelter for his people and the strength of the children of Israel. See the words like Zion, Jerusalem, Israel? Make no mistake, friends, when Jesus comes back, he's coming back to rescue Israel. That's his prime objective, is he's coming back to rescue them. They will get in a spot and no one will stand with them, and he will come back. Verse 17, so you shall know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then Jerusalem shall be holy, and no aliens shall ever pass through her again. No aliens. And watch, we're not talking about UFOs here. That's not the kind of aliens that we're talking about. We're talking about foreign nations. There will no longer be foreign nations ruling over Jerusalem, telling the Jews what to do, telling Israel what to do. Verse 18, and it will come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drip with new wine, the hills shall flow with milk. This is after Jesus comes back. And all the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord and water the valley of Acacias. Now, when it talks about mountains, wine, milk, we're talking about agricultural prosperity, not really real wine flowing in the mountains. We're talking about there'll be grapes, there's going to be, the cows will be, you think the California cows are happy? Ain't nothing compared to the cows in Israel when Jesus comes back, okay? So wine, milk, it says a fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord and water the valley of Acacias. Joel is describing a brand new water source in Jerusalem coming directly from under the temple. Ezekiel said the same thing about the same day. Then he brought me, Ezekiel 47:1, then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the front of the temple faced east, and the water was flowing from the right side of the temple south of the altar. And it says it will go to water the valley of Acacias. Now, I know Acacia Street is just over here. We're not talking about Acacia. Don't go there. We're talking about the Dead Sea. Acacia trees are these trees that grow in this desert wilderness out in the south of Israel. And when you come to Israel with us on our next trip, you'll see it, because we'll spend time, we'll go down to the Dead Sea, and you'll see these acacia trees. So he's talking about the water flowing into the Dead Sea, which Ezekiel also talks about in Ezekiel 47. Now, when it talks about water flowing from the altar, it could be that the water is going to flow down the Kidron Valley, which it could do. It could actually do that. Or it could be that, well, remember the mountain splits? Maybe it's going to do that straight shot thing down into the Dead Sea. Either way, the water is going to flow to the Dead Sea. Ezekiel says that the Dead Sea will be healed. Because, by the way, you don't get a fishing license yet for the Dead Sea. They'll laugh at you. I've heard of people trying to get fishing licenses for the future, for when things get changed. But right now, nothing can survive the Dead Sea. The salt content, the mineral content is way too high. But when this happens, the water will flow in, and the Dead Sea will be brought to life. And there'll be fish swimming. There'll be fishing in the Dead Sea. Verse 19. Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom a desolate wilderness. Edom is southern Jordan. Because the violence against the people of Judah, for they have shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall abide forever, and Jerusalem from generation to generation. For I will acquit them of the guilt of bloodshed whom I had not acquitted, for the Lord dwells in Zion. The New Living Translation says, I will pardon my people's crimes, which I have not yet pardoned, and I, the Lord, will make my home in Jerusalem with my people. Now, how come the Jews get this free pass? How come God forgives their sins? How can he do that when they've rejected Jesus for so long? Well, gang, they're not going to be rejecting Jesus. Because Paul says in Romans 11 that the blindness that's on them now will be lifted and they will turn to the Messiah. Romans 11, 26, he says, and so all Israel will be saved at this time. As it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion. He will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. They're going to be just like us. You've got to turn to Jesus. If you want forgiveness, you've got to turn to Jesus. One last thing I want to just point out. The fountain shall flow from under the altar. You know what, friends? There's going to be a day when Jesus comes back. And it's all going to be good. Right now, not so much. Right now, things suck, right? You and I need to keep going. You need to hang in there. Because there is a day when he will come back. It may be soon. Could be. It could be 10 years from now. You need to hang in there. You need to follow him. There's a commercial that's been out for 3 weeks. It's already had 15 million hits on YouTube. It's about a kid in Fullerton who's going to be playing in the Super Bowl this afternoon. Now, actually, there are two kids from Fullerton that are going to be playing in the Super Bowl just for my Broncos fans. They're both from Troy. Aaron Brewer is the long snapper for the Broncos. But this is about a buddy of ours. My sons knew him. They played with him. His name is Derek Coleman.
They told me it couldn't be done. That I was a lost cause. I was picked on and picked last. Coaches didn't know how to talk to me. They gave up on me. Told me I should just quit.
Don't move until I move. Move until I move.
And the last bit is...
They didn't call my name. Told me it was over. But I've been deaf since I was three. So I didn't listen. And now I'm here with a lot of fans in the NFL cheering me on. And I can hear them all.
You look for number 40 today. He'll be playing fullback if he plays. Derek didn't quit. You don't quit. You don't need to quit. You need to keep going. Because Jesus is coming back. He's coming back. You want to be ready? When he comes back, will he find faith on the earth? Is he going to see you being faithful? Let's stand and pray.